So thank you. I'll talk about Riemann surfaces in Schnabel gauge, but this is actually what I'll try to lead up to. So we have to talk about some other things first before we can get there. So my basic plan is I'll first make a quick review of how things work in Siegel gauge. We are all familiar with that, but just to remind ourselves and to see how things get a little bit more complicated in other cases. Then second of all, I'll talk about general linear B gauges, which is a very general class of gauges, and I'll argue that, well, things become more complicated in this case in every respect, actually, generically. But then for one particular linear B gauge, which is Schnabel gauge, actually, we will find some very nice simplifications that make actually this whole endeavor worth it. So that's my plan. Okay, so let me start with a quick review on Siegel gauge. And please interrupt me and ask questions anytime, so I hope this is going to be very interactive. Okay, so let me start with Siegel gauge. So we're all familiar with the Warren's gauge condition, which is simply B0 on psi equals 0. And so something that is sometimes useful is a projector onto the gauge slice. And as a projector, we can, for example, use B0, C0. So C0 acting on any state is going to project it into the gauge slice. And so our kinetic operator is usually just a BRST operator Q, but if we're trying to gauge fix this, we can simply wedge it so we can have Q, and then we'd like to project onto the gauge slice, but also we'd like to have the BPC conjugate projection on the other side, and this would be something like a gauge fixed kinetic operator. Let me just call this K. But of course, this is not how we usually write it, because I mean B0 C0 star is very simple. This is simply Z0 B0, and then we have a Z0 B0, and we can try to move it past Q. That would kill the B0 squared. So we get the anti-commutator between B0 and Q, which is simply L0. So we end up with Z0, L0, B0, C0. And as a final step, we can move the C0 past this B0. That would kill the C0, C0 squared. So we simply end up with the anti-commutator of those two guys, and that's 1. So we have the usual gauge fixed kinetic operator, which is Z0, L0. Now, the next thing we of course want is a propagator. Well, we all know what the propagator is in Siegel gauge. The propagator is simply B0 over L0. Now, why is that the propagator? Well, so the propagator inverts the kinetic operator on the gauge slice. So P times K is simply the projection onto the gauge slice. So, well, right. So the L0 cancels and we have B0, Z0 left over. So everything is very simple in this case. Now we might want to, of course we want to somehow make contact with Riemann surfaces. So what we usually do is a Schwinger parameterization of 1 over L0, which means that we write the 1 over L0 as an integral over ds from 0 to infinity of e to the minus SL0. And this operator, e to the minus SL0, generates Riemann surfaces. So how can we think of that? So let's start here. So if we have some Fock space state, which we, as we learned, for example, we can represent it as an operator insertion, let's say phi on the upper half unit disk, and it's basically this surface represents the Fock space state. Let me just call this the Xi frame. Then e to the minus SL0, of course, simply generates rescalings in this frame. So that means what this operator does is it adds a little bit of surface out here. So then we basically go from 1 to e to the s. And there's another very familiar representation of the surface, which I'll call the W frame, which is basically simply the logarithm of this frame. And in this case, the propagator strip is simply a rectangle. So for now this is overkill, but for later it might be useful. let me mark these boundaries. So in this W frame, this is the W frame, and here we have pi, and here we have 0 to s. So this then simply becomes a strip of length s and width pi in this frame. And L0, of course, in this frame is simply the generator of translations. So that's all I want to say right now first. Oh, is there a question? There's one more thing that we have to think about in signal gauge, which we actually usually don't think about, and that is, this is the gauge fixing for the classical string field, basically the string field of ghost number one. Now, of course, we have a gauge symmetry there, that means we should add ghosts and ghosts of ghosts and the corresponding anti-ghosts. And we again gauge, so we gauge fix these and we get to ghost of ghost of ghosts and so on and so forth. But we can actually, so what happens is that that we take the string field psi in the end not to be of ghost number one but to be an arbitrary ghost number. But we impose the same gauge condition V0 psi on all of those, and we use the same propagator for all the ghosts as we use for the classical string field. So there we sort of forget about what we actually did. We simply use everything as if it were the classical string field, but of course that has to be justified. And this actually becomes more complicated in other gauges. Are there any questions about that up to now? Okay, good. So now let's carry out the same thing. Let's first of all not restrict ourselves to this simple gauge condition B0 psi equals 0, but instead let's take some more general gauge condition B psi equals 0, where this B is some linear combination. Let me call this B2K. B2K. And k is in z, and we take all of these b to k's to be real. So now you'll already notice that in particular Martin's or Schnabel's b is in this more general class of gauges, but I'll not commit now to any particular b, but I'll just keep this very general. In particular, I don't necessarily want this b to be BPZ even. That was something that helped us a lot over here. So how does the gauge fix kinetic operator? Well, we'll just carry out the same steps as we did over here. Well, so then, first of all, it's not clear whether we can use C0, but as long as we have some operator C that has the properties that B with C equals 1, as long as we have some operator of this kind, we can write a projection onto the gauge slice as BC. So what we get is BC, Q, and BC. Now, because B star is not necessarily equal to B, we cannot do a similar simplification as we did over there. Now, what is the propagator in this case? So the propagator is not going to be simply B0 over some L. It might be useful to define at this moment this operator, which is simply the BRST transformation of B. Notice that this is the generalization of L0 over here, because L0 is Q on B, anti-commutative with B0. And so the propagator for such a gauge where B is not BPZ even or not necessarily BPZ even is the classical propagator is B over L QB star over L star. Now, if B actually happens to be BPZ even, then this B over L, this here simply is B over L also, and then we can do this trick of moving B past B squared would kill itself, so we only pick up the anti-commutative of B with Q, that cancels an L, and we are left with B over L, which is the generalization of this B0 over L0. But we cannot do that in general. Now, there's something seems to be wrong with this propagator. So the first naive thing that one might think is wrong is it has two Schwinger parameters if we parameterize it in a generalization of this form. But that's actually not a problem because we also have a Q. And Q acts as a derivative on moduli space. So in some sense we have an extra parameter and an extra derivative. So in some sense that's fine. But there's something else that's wrong with this P, and that is that Q with P is unequal to 1. And that is a very nice property to have. In particular, if you're looking at trying to prove that your gauge gives the correct on-shell amplitude or that your gauge states decouple, you always want when you move your Q past the propagator that it collapses the propagator. And this is not the case for this. So, and actually the reason why this fails is connected to something that I said earlier on, which is that we've been too naive about the gauge fixing of the ghosts. So actually we cannot impose this gauge condition on all ghost numbers. And in fact, so in general we want so let's generalize, let's say we just want some BG that fixes the string field at ghost number G. And it turns out the only way to consistently do that is if B3 minus G is BG star, BPC conjugate. So this is actually the condition that we need, but for this talk I'll not use the complete freedom that this condition gives us. Instead, I'll do something that we call alternating gauge, which is that we simply use, by pi plus minus, I want to denote the projector onto even or odd ghost numbers. So the gauge fixing that I have in mind now is that we simply do this. Pi minus, pi plus, psi equals 0. So this simply, this is an alternating gauge, so the odd ghost numbers have the original gauge condition, and the even ghost numbers have the BPC conjugate gauge condition. So what is the propagator that corresponds to this gauge fixing condition? And it turns out this propagator, so now this is the propagator for all ghost numbers, well, this was the classical propagator, is simply this. Is what we saw early on, B star over L star, but now this is projected onto even ghost numbers, and then we get an extra term where these they are reversed, B over L pi minus, and this is the complete propagator in alternating gauge, and this one does satisfy. Let me write this as a nice property that QP equals 1.
So I have a question.
Yes.
So can you remind me why you don't allow odd B ghosts in your gauge?
Oh, okay, good. So by making this, first of all, we have two conditions here. One is that the Vs are real, and the other one is that I don't allow odd ones.
Yeah.
And this may be relaxed, but but the reason why we impose these conditions is twofold. The first one is connected to the reality condition for the string field.
Okay.
So we would like to, when you have some general string field, we'd like to be able to form linear combination to project it into a string field in the gauge that satisfies the reality condition. That is one condition that comes in here. And the second condition that comes in here that we'd like to give e to the minus SL with this L a Riemann surface interpretation in terms of that, so that this L generates open string conformal transformations. And if you impose these two conditions, I'm not sure you have to, but for us that seemed sensible to do, then you end up with this restricted class of B operators. Are there any other questions? So we'll get on conditions for V. So right now, I haven't told you yet which Bs actually give you the correct on-shell amplitudes and so forth. We will talk about that. Are there any other questions? Let me check if I forgot anything to tell you anything. Good. So now to see which Vs are nice, we're going towards Riemann surfaces, so we'll again to the parameterize 1 over L, this time as ds 0 to infinity e to the minus sl. Now at this stage, this is a very formal thing, and it's not clear whether it's even legal to do this. But I'll give you a condition on these Vs for which this is a legal thing to do. And so what does this e to the minus SL look like? Well, the first thing that we might want to try is, again, in this Xi frame. So we have our Fox base state. And now we are acting with e to the minus SL. And instead of generating rescalings in this frame, this is going to give you something a little... This can give you... Well, okay, so let me make this a little bit more symmetric. Not sure I succeeded. This is going to generate a little bit of a stranger surface here. And so what is... How do I know which surface is generated? And the trick is to regard this as a vector field. So we're writing... V of Xi is the sum, again, of K and Z, V to K, Xi to K plus 1. So I can interpret these coefficients as a vector field. And I'd, so and to find sensible gauges, I'll try to find conditions on this vector field V. And
the symmetry, do you have a symmetry because of the even?
Right. So. So this is really symmetric in this direction, and this really generates a surface along the real axis on this point. So the vector field really points horizontally here and here, and it is symmetric around this axis. So that's all the conditions I've that are derived from this form. But so this is not a very good frame to look at this vector field, because what can happen is that after some finite evolution in S, that this the surface generated here, that the vector field runs into some singularity or something. But that doesn't mean that the gauge is necessarily bad. It just means that this frame, this is more coordinate singularity. And it is sort of clear. I mean, if e to the minus some, let's say, some delta L generates a nice surface, then e to the minus 2 delta L, which is simply the square of this, cannot have a problem. It must also have a nice surface interpretation. So if this has a nice surface interpretation, this one must have a nice surface interpretation, but that may not be possible in this frame. So as long as I'm fine up to some finite delta that can be pretty small, there must be some nice frame in which I can represent this propagator strip that is attached by this e to the minus SL surface. Okay, hold on.
Is there some sign important thing here? I mean, can L0 switch sign?
No.
So if you chose minus B0 instead of B0, wouldn't that cause problems?
Okay, good. So there is going to be a... So in some sense, I've already, just by making this vector field pointing outward here, I made some choice. So the sign is important, and we'll have a condition on V so that something like this even makes sense. So no worries. We'll get to it. But first, let's look at a nicer frame. So... And what a nice frame that I'll look at is what I'll call the W frame, which satisfies the following condition, namely that dW over dXi is 1 over V of Xi. So this defines me some frame, W of Xi. And what is nice about this frame is that in this frame, this V of Xi simply generates translations. So what we will have in this case is that in this W frame, okay, so what did I use? I used red for the inside and blue for the outside. So this width here is pi, and this length here is s. So in this W frame, in this W frame, the propagator strip is generated by translations. And it's obvious that, of course, in this frame, I can go to arbitrary large S. There's nothing going to break down if I just generate translations. And so, for example, if I'd like, I mean, acting on some Fock space state, what that would mean, if you have your Fock space state phi here, and you're acting with this propagator, just means that you have to glue these to each other. But of course, maybe in this frame, the Fock space state might not have a nice representation. So, I mean, but on the level of Riemann surfaces, this is fine. I have one Riemann surface, I glue it to another one, and that one is defined to arbitrary large S. Good. So now the first thing that you noticed probably is that here these edges are different than in Siegel gauge. So actually, this curve here, although it still has to be symmetric around here, around pi half, it can be. It doesn't have to be vertical anymore. And whether this curve is vertical or not depends on whether the gauge condition is BPZ even or not. So if this curve is vertical, the gauge is BPZ even. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily Siegel gauge, because the parametrization along this line is going to be different if I don't have Siegel gauge, but a different BPZ even gauge. Are there questions about this? So now let me do this whole thing in a third frame, which is sort of a trivial thing, but will be very nice later on, is that I can simply go to e to the w or 1 half e to the w. Normalization doesn't matter. And in this case, it takes the following form. So let me call this the z frame. Okay, let me write this a little bit clearer. Z is 1 half e to the w. And in this frame, it's going to look a little bit like, so the inner one, like this. And the outer one is going to be of this form. And it's obvious if, as this generates translations in the W frame, it's going to generate rescalings in the Z frame. Sorry about that. So that if this is at 1 half, this is at e to the s half. And are there any questions about that?
I think just maybe you could say, I thought one equation may help people here understand that L is the integral of V times T.
So the way I defined L here, of course, this is simply, well, okay, good. So L can be written as, I guess, V of Xi, T of Xi.
And that's what shows that if you pass to W coordinates, then it becomes a translation out of that.
And, I mean, the B was the same thing, just with the B replaced here instead of the T.
Well, I guess it's also on the next equation, because you could just, you didn't write it as a translation, but V ddc is equal to dw, something like that. I assume that's what you meant.
Right. So, okay, good. So I could write this up here and this up here to make this more manifest, I guess. Yeah.
So you assume that V of C doesn't vanish for any C?
Let me talk about conditions where this actually makes sense, this whole construction. It's been sort of formal up to now, and by pretending that all of this has this nice shape, I've been sort of... I've been making some assumptions that I didn't tell you about. So let's get to this right now. Good. So what would we like? So first of all, for this Schwinger parametrization to make sense, what we really need is that we can sort of drop the term at infinity. So when the Schwinger parameter gets very large, we want to drop those terms. So when can we drop those terms? We can drop those terms if the Riemann surface that corresponds to it is degenerate in this limit. So it has some open string degeneration. At least that's what one formally does. I mean, that's what one also does in Siegel gauge, and we're not going to do any better than in Siegel gauge conceptually. So conceptually, that's what we want to do. So when does that work? Well, if I have a nice curve like this, in this frame, then this always works. Because if I take large S enough, S large enough, then I always have a strip of infinite length that I can eventually put in here. That becomes larger and larger and larger. And as S goes to infinity, then I can drop those terms. So as long as this curve here is sufficiently nice behaved, one can go ahead and start with that, with the Schwinger parameterization, and actually prove that this gauge produces the correct on-shell amplitudes, and that pure gauge stays decouple, which are two properties that we'd like to have of a nice gauge. So when does that work? Well, so there is a condition on the gauge condition on these V's, which I'm going to phrase in terms of this vector field V of Xi, which is the following. So I'll call those regular linear B gauges. And that is, the condition is the following. And it is that the real part of Xi bar V of Xi is larger than zero. So what does that mean? Now, this is a fancy way of simply saying that the vector field in this frame is pointing outward everywhere. In particular, it's non-vanishing on the upper half unit circle. And in particular, then we can solve this equation and don't have problems here. Now, I want to emphasize that while for regular linear B gauges, one can prove that all amplitudes are reproduced correctly, that doesn't mean that a gauge that violates this in some way, maybe in some mild way, is inconsistent. It just means that we have to work a little bit harder to prove it, if it is consistent. Are there any questions about that? Okay, good. So let me again check if I've got to tell you something, and then we can move on to Schnabel gauge, actually. Oh, yeah, actually, one more thing that's interesting.
So okay. Can I ask a stupid question? What is the vector field? V is a function. What is the vector field you're talking about here?
Yeah, so, it is a vector field. Well, it is a complex function, right? So on the unit disk, you can interpret this as a vector field.
So you're just taking function, the value of the function.
The value of the function, yeah. It's a two-dimensional vector field.
That was the question.
Okay. So let me say that I want this condition should be imposed only at the unit circle, and that that's the condition that we impose.
Yeah, it seems to be upside down. What equation?
This one?
V should be upside down. Look at L. Yeah.
L.
I d v times V should be W. Dw.
I'm sorry, which equation? Is this one is wrong?
The differential equation, dw d psi, should be V, not 1 over V.
Oh, oh. No. I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Well, look at L and W.
Okay, let's do this. So dw dx is 1 over v, okay, that's correct.
It is correct.
But let's, okay,
have
let's
to do the full transform, conformal transform.
Oh, because.
Yeah, so t is t dimension is 2. So the correct definition that we, for regular linear B gauges that we gave, is at the unit circle, it should satisfy this, and it should be analytic in a neighborhood of the unit circle. And that's sufficient.
Why is it good enough to be in the neighborhood?
Well, because then this curve gamma, it will have a finite height and finite spread. And that means when I take S large enough, I can always get a degeneration. So the surface that is then added by e to the minus SL is perfectly fine then.
So V at C has a zero, let's say at C equals 2. That's not
a problem. No problem. So it can have poles, it can have zeros, it can have lots of things.
question. What happens if you let B of 2k only to be zero for very small for small mode numbers, but you make it really big for large mode numbers? What do those sort of surfaces look like?
Oh, you take it large for large mode numbers? Well, question is whether then it's gonna converge on the unit circle at all. Whether this, it might. I mean, it has to be analytic in the neighborhood of the unit circle. If you take the large coefficients very large, then you might have some issues with that. It depends on what you mean by large, I guess.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, good. So now let me add one more thing. And that is, as we saw here, the propagator isn't quite such an easy star. It's not just e to the minus SL, right? It's also an e to the minus SL star. So what is the surface corresponding to that? And so in the W frame, it's actually very simple. It's simply the reflected one of this one. So it sort of has this shape. And then some width S star, and well, I guess I can take a new color of this form. And so these are going to be glued. And now you can also see why things simplify if you have a BPC even gauge condition. In this case, these things are simply vertical, so you can actually really literally glue them. And I mean, that makes sense. In the end, it's e to the minus SL and e to the minus S star L star in this case are the same thing. So you have to simply have e to the minus S plus S star L.
Right. Another way of saying it, that BPC even choices are obtained by midpoint preservatory parameterization from Siegel gauge.
Right, right. So this, in some sense, you can start with a parameterization of this line and then reparameterize this line and get all BPC even gauge choices. Absolutely. So, but there's another way I can do this. I can think of this a little bit differently. I can think of this as the surface flipped and simply glue, make this gluing explicit. So I'm not sure that my drawing skills are very, can make this, but I'll give it a shot. So we will have this. I'll try to draw it at a little angle to say that these are separate surfaces. So I'm adding this thing here. Oh, this one goes the other way. I'm sorry. Thanks. Okay. So I hope. So.
What are you drawing?
Okay, that's what I was afraid of. So I'm.
You erased the one you had. Leave it there.
Okay, maybe that helps. So I had this one. So I'm doing this because it's going to be useful later, so not just for fun. Okay, so instead of just saying I'm gluing these two, I can take this, think of it as a piece of paper, I can flip it over and make the gluing manifest here, but then I have a surface that is sort of overlapping, right? But then I'm basically going, so I'm adding this surface. You should think of this as some.
This slanting three. Is just for visualization.
The slanting is just there is no real slant. This is just to make it sort of three-dimensional, seem three-dimensional. And of course, the same thing carries over here. So I could have this going backwards here. Let me forget about the slant this time. Let's do this. Okay, so of course you can see I have trouble flipping, I can't really flip this up. Like here, I can't flip this back without bending it. Okay, just for illustration. Any questions about this? Okay, good. So now let's talk about Schnabel gauge, because this is what we are here for after all. So Schnabel gauge. So in Schnabel gauge, the V of psi takes this form, 1 plus psi squared, and then arc tangent of psi. Yeah. So now this one is almost satisfied with condition almost everywhere. And the only point where that's subtle, where it violates this condition, is at the midpoint. As usual, the midpoint plays a prominent role. So how does that affect these figures? Clearly, it can't be of this form. There must be something going wrong in each one of these frames. So let's look at this frame, at the W frame first. So in the W frame, again, I have something that's of width S. And it starts off fine here. And similarly from below this, it starts off fine. But then at the midpoint, this whole thing goes off to infinity. So the surface again, so this is the propagator surface. And these lines are somewhere glued. These two surfaces are glued somewhere off at infinity. We don't see it in this frame. So now we can immediately see what goes wrong with arguing that there's a degeneration at large Schwinger parameter. Because we can take S arbitrarily large as long as we go far enough out here, the two boundaries are arbitrarily close to each other. So of course one can make this more rigorous and actually show that there is no open string degeneration or no infinite extreme length between those two boundaries at arbitrarily large Schwinger parameters. In fact, it's always zero. Now again, you might now worry and think, okay, let's just trash Schnabel gauge, because I mean, that's something that we really want when Schwinger parameters become large, that we can throw away those surfaces. We want degenerations. But actually, but we've been a little bit too strict. We've been demanding that the propagator strip by itself, when S becomes large, becomes a degenerate Riemann surface. What we really want is in some loop calculation or in some tree calculation, doesn't matter, that the Riemann surface associated with this amplitude becomes degenerate when the Schwinger parameters become large. So there's going to be more things glued to this propagator, and as long as they help it make the surface degenerate at large S, that's fine.
The one thing that could help is a restriction on the allowed external open string functions. If I take an open string function which is well behaved at the mixed point, I can imagine that this would not be a problem.
Right. So in particular, if you just, right, I mean, as you saw in the four-point function, as long as I just glue two Fock space states on this side and two Fock space states on this side, I'll always get a degenerate Riemann surface when I take the Schwinger parameters large, at least one of them by itself large. Okay, but
is the reason for studying Schnabel gauges that you want to study these other vacua where the Kakian is condensed? I mean, is that why one is?
I don't know. For me, that would not be the primary reason, but that might be an interesting way of thinking. An application.
The main application of it at this point, or?
The reason why. So for what I'm going to talk about, Yuji is going to talk about some other interesting application. But for what I'm talking about right now, I'm just looking at amplitude calculations in Schnabel gauge. And what I'm trying to argue is that off-shell amplitudes are actually calculable as functions of the Schwinger parameters, which does not happen in Siegel gauge. And the reason this does not happen in Siegel gauge is because, in principle, I'll erase this in a second. In principle, it looks very nice. You have propagator strips that are simply rectangles, and you have Fock space states for your external lines that you're sort of gluing. You have lots of Fock space states, phi1. Phi2, and lots of propagators floating around that you're sort of gluing all to each other. But the final surface that you results from this, you'll have a hard time mapping this to a disk or to an annulus at one loop level. Actually, at one loop, that's not even for the tadpole, you can't do that as an explicit function of the Schwinger parameter S. So this is what I'm saying right now, the main motivation.
But Leonardo said that the Schnabel gauge was just a transformation from the Siegel gauge by one of these K transformations, whatever you want to call it.
No.
That's not what I said.
He was talking about BPC even gauge choices. Schnabel gauge is not a BPC even gauge choice because you don't have a two-sided, the sum is not two-sided.
So what's different in the condition on V?
Oh, so that would be V2K equals V minus 2K would be the condition for BPC even gauge choice.
Okay.
Yes. How does this propagator strip look when we glue just single Fox tape?
Good. So actually, let me do that. Good idea. So now what we do is we map this to something like a Z frame, because here, I mean, even in Siegel gauge, that's sort of subtle, putting a Fox base state here. The Fox base state operator insertion is somewhere at infinity. So let's do it in a frame like this. And of course, what comes out is exactly, I mean, what all of you probably expect by now. Is that this simply becomes precisely vertical. And the outer, so this is at 1/2. And the other one at minus 1/2, of course. And the other side also becomes vertical. And this is at e to the s half. So this is the propagator surface now. It sort of seems to be disconnected into two parts, similarly to what we see. So here in the W frame, the left and the right part. And of course, we can very naturally, I mean, this is the sliver frame. So we can very naturally put a Fox base state right here in the middle by the usual map that we've seen many times, with a coordinate line going off like this. And this is how this propagator acts on a Fox base state. Now you may think, oh, hold on, I've seen this before. These are wedge states, right? Aren't this, I'm adding a little bit of strip here and strip here? But that's not true. And the reason why that's not true is because recall that in this frame, in the Z frame, the propagator surface is generated by rescalings. While wedges had the same parametrization on the left and on the right side, here we have the parametrization shift. It sort of goes out like this. So it's a rescaled parametrization by e to the s on this side. So let's just call them slanted wedges. And like wedges, slanted wedges also have a nice algebra. Instead of one-dimensional, it has two. Well, it can be represented by 2x2 matrices, but I might be talking about this later. We'll see how much time we have. So formally, a propagator acts simply by gluing vertical strips and by changing the reparametrization out here. And so also something else that I'm not going to go into detail later on, but let me mention it at this point, is that if you recall this, if we have e to the minus s star, L star acting.
One blue vertical line.
Oh, absolutely. That's... okay.
Yeah.
Good. So hold on. Let me correct this whole picture and get it straight. So we have a red line here. We have a blue line here. And we have a new yellow line here. So now what? So what e to the minus so e to the minus s star l star, what it does is it takes a little, it has the same surface, but it goes inside. So we have an overlapping surface here. But now we see what we can actually do. I mean, now we have vertical lines, so we can actually flip it out in this frame. So this is very different from the flipping that we did in the W frame, where we simply did this. Now we're doing sort of this. But again, we have vertical lines in this frame. We can flip it out, and then after this, after flipping it out, let me erase this, I have added another slanted wedge to the outside here. But the difference now is that while here the parametrization of the outer line went up, it's going down now. Because recall, we have flipped it basically from here So this is the parameterization. When we flip it over, it's going to be at the same point. So we have, we add a slanted wedge that's sort of slanted in the opposite way. Any questions about this?
So is the wedge like standard element of the Hilbert space in the slanted wedge?
No. Okay, that's a good question. So how should we interpret a slanted wedge? So the first thing is you might think, oh, is that something like a state in the Hilbert space, but it's not. And actually, probably as Yuji is going to be explaining later on a little bit more in detail than I'll explain right now, one should think of these slanted wedges not so much as open string states, but in some sense they're closer to closed string states. So, and so, well, to see this, let's first, okay. I'm jumping ahead, so let's not jump ahead. I'll try to answer your question in more detail later on.
You're saying it's not a surface state?
No, it's not a surface state because it has an extra boundary. Although we have pushed it up to I infinity, when you see it in a regularized way here, you see that there is, if I just look at the slanted wedge on one side, it has some boundary here, which connects it to the slanted wedge on the other side. So this slanted wedge here and this slanted wedge are connected at I infinity across a boundary. And then you can see if we identify both sides, then we can sort of think of this as a closed string curve. And this is, okay, I'm jumping ahead, but this is how you can interpret it.
But if you glue the slanted wedge onto a Fuchs state, then you can interpret it as a surface state?
You can interpret it as a surface state as long as you glue slanted wedges on both sides that have equal slant. So as long as the parameterization on the left side after your operation is the same as on the right side, as we have here with the whole propagator acting on the Fuchs space state, you're fine.
How does it look compared to the disk?
Oh, you can map this like a wedge to the disk, and that's... So there is... So how does it look like when mapped to the disk? So one way of looking at it, like if I just want to map it to the half disk somehow, let's say I want this yellow line to be here in the middle, then that's going to look fine here. So we'll have Fuchs space state in here, and we'll have a red line here. Oh, sorry, no, the red line is right at the boundary. And a blue line here. Sunset, well, more or less. So it's fine to map this to, I mean, you can map it to the disk. But, okay. But, okay, let me try to give you an example so that you can see all of this a little bit more clear. So let's look at the one loop tadpole. And let's look at a simplified picture where we simply take e to the minus s l as the propagator. So again, or b e to the minus s l. I'm only going to be focusing, as up to now, on Riemann surfaces. The b insertions go along for the ride, and they're actually very simple in these frames, and they'll be necessary for the computations, for example, that Yuji is going to talk about. But for right now, let me just focus on Riemann surfaces. So, and as I said before, because e to the minus s star l star also is nicely represented in this algebra of slanted wedges, everything I'm going to talk about is not going to only work for the one-loop tadpole with a simplified propagator, but it's going to work for any propagator, for the full propagator, and it will work for any one-loop amplitude. So it could be some non-planar 20-point function, and you can make all the maps explicit. But let's do the simplest case. So let me draw the one loop, just now the topology of the one loop tadpole, just to remind you. So we have an external state strip. There's some Fuchs space state that's coming in here with its coordinate lines, maybe. And then here's the propagator. Here is the midpoint of the propagator that sort of got pushed off to infinity in this frame. So now what we need is a Fox space state and e to the minus SL as the propagator. So that's basically this picture that we had here. We have all the ingredients there, so we just need to see how the identifications work in this picture. So let me draw this picture again. So this is Z. So we have the Fox space state. And then here, let me split this into a left and a right part of the propagator. So this is the right part of the propagator. So this is this thing here. So that is glued to the right part of the Fox space state. So here we need to glue the right part of the propagator, something like this. And then when the propagator comes back, the right part, it's identified with the left part of the Fox space state. So we have an identification between here and the left part here, something like this. Now what happens to the left part of the propagator, which is sort of the inside here? And you see this is sort of disconnected. At the end, it gets identified with itself. And only at the midpoint, which is shoved off to infinity in this figure, it gets glued to this surface. So we sort of have a disconnected surface on the other side. So this is supposed to be just a slit to show that it's disconnected. There's no actual... just to make the left part of the propagator as in this frame. So we have an identification on this side. So this is the left part of the propagator. And something seems very wrong in this picture. And what's wrong here is that recall this here is at minus e to the s half, and this here is at minus 1/2. But even if we increase s to something very large, this always seems to be something like a cylinder. And why is it something like a cylinder? Because, well, you have a vertical strip, and both sides are identified. Now, if this is really an infinite cylinder, that means the annulus that this corresponds to would be closed string degenerate, because we would, between the inner boundary of the cylinder and the outer boundary of the cylinder, we'd have an infinite... between the inner boundary of the annulus and the outer boundary of the annulus, we'd have an infinite cylinder. That means that the inner boundary basically just becomes a point. But that's not what we want. As we vary the propagator, we want to cover moduli space. We want to get all possible annulus moduli. But actually, this argument is too naive, because this is not really a cylinder. And one way of thinking about this is that a cylinder sort of has the property that when you take the shortest curve from one end of the cylinder to the other end of the cylinder, that's sort of proportional to the area of the cylinder. And that is another way of saying that the extremal length becomes infinite, because the extremal length is something like the shortest curve divided by the shortest curve squared divided by the area. So, but this is not what happens here, because the shortest curve isn't just the... So we can have a dumb curve that just goes straight up. But that's not the shortest curve. The shortest curve makes use of these identifications. It actually goes here, jumps up here, and goes over here, and jumps further up. So it becomes much, much shorter. So this argument is too naive. So what is the right answer? Well, it turns out we can actually explicitly map this to an annulus, and the way we do it is the following. The first step, so on the left side, it's sort of already nice, because this boundary that is identified with this boundary are simply rescalings by e to the s. Now, let's try to get the same thing on the right side. And that's very easy. We just shift the strip to the right. So what we end up with... is the following. We still have this here on this side, where the identifications are really just rescalings by e to the s through the midpoint. And then on the right side, we actually, after our correctly chosen shift, we get this exact same picture. Where this one, we shifted in a way so that this one then goes through the origin, so that we have this identification, basically. And now life becomes simple. because we can map this now to W frame-like thing. So basically by taking the logarithm, so how does it look like then? So on the one side, on this side, this is simply the old, we haven't done anything to this side, so this must be the same figure as over here. So the W frame, this is going to simply look like this. But on the other side, we again have identifications by e to the s between here and here. That means the left boundary and the right boundary are also going to be related by translations by s in this frame. So what this is going to look like is a little bit like this. So this sort of bends over here. And then we have something of this sort. But this curve and this curve are just going to be translations by S. And now we can map this, so you're still worried about this infinitely long curve, but what actually happens when we now map this to the annulus, and let me write down, I never remember the precise map. No, theta, how can I write a theta? Is exponential of 2 pi I over S ln 2z, then what is this going to look like? On the inside, so we have the inner side. Let me mark this. This is the inner open string boundary, which is here. And by this map, these points get identified. This map naturally has the identification that a translation by S comes back to itself.
2 pi I S times W.
Oh, sorry, this is the Z map, actually. So then this is W, I'm sorry. Yeah. And then we have this midpoint that is sort of a little bit subtle. But important is that this whole surface is going to be filled out, and that here on the inside we get the one half of the propagator, and this infinite line here simply becomes a cutting, sort of a cutting curve of this annulus. So it winds around and winds around and winds around, but in the end, as it's identified, it doesn't matter. It's just a very strange way of cutting up this annulus, but the annulus is perfectly fine. And then on the outside, so we get the outer boundary of the annulus at radius 1, let's say. And then we have our Fock space state. Okay, I'm going to get into trouble then drawing how they wind around together. So they're going to wind around an infinite number of times. But the point is that we can actually find a very explicit map. We can map all the operator insertions that we have in this frame explicitly to the annulus. And the annulus, we know everything about this annulus. It has an inner radius of e to the minus pi squared over 2 pi squared over s. And all the maps in between are explicitly known. So then we can actually compute correlators. And we can clearly do this. I mean, nothing here depended on the fact that we... I'll be done in 1 minute. Nothing here depended on the fact that we had the simplified propagator. We could have had this extra strip and just adjusted the corresponding shift. We could have, instead of a Fock space state, we could have had some general wedge state, which is, for example, necessary if your loop diagram isn't just an external state here, but instead something more complicated like an internal tree that's starting off here of some kind. Then instead of a Fock space state here, we simply insert the wedge that corresponds to this subtree. So we can generalize this to the full propagator, and we can generalize it to an arbitrary number of insertions on both sides of the inner and outer boundary of the loop diagram and to arbitrary complicated amplitudes.
The modulus is always the same.
Oh, very good point. So let me emphasize, this is actually very... So the modulus only depends on the propagators that run here in the loop. It does not the annulus modulus. The annulus modulus is simply m is pi over the sum of the sum goes over all Schwinge of all propagators that go in the loop, and it's Si minus Si star. So it's a very simple form. So basically, it's simply this S here gets replaced by this sum. That's all you need to do. So we can explicitly map it to a very simple annulus. And in particular, this annulus modulus does not depend on whether you insert here a Fock space state or a huge wedge. As long as this wedge has slant zero, i.e. it is a regular wedge, the annulus that you map to is precisely the same. And I think Yuji is going to make some use of this fact. So in the interest of time, let me stop here and ask for questions.
So this modulus you have at the end, it's just more or less the same as you would expect from like Feynman diagrams or something, except you have pi over the thing because you're going sort of in the wrong direction and you're going along the width of the cylinder instead of length. Is that the idea?
Okay, so I mean, you're saying maybe one should... So I think in this W frame, this this modulus is simply the width, basically, of this... of this strip and the length divided by the length of the strip. That means if this becomes large, you're at open string degeneration, while if this becomes very small, you're at closed string degeneration. What is sort of fascinating here is this minus sign, because this minus sign means that you can... It's very counterintuitive, because you have some kind of a strip with both sides identified. And then when you add a little bit of extra strip corresponding to an e to the minus s star l star, so you're adding a little bit and identifying again, this strip becomes actually conformally shorter. It doesn't become longer. So that's something that's very surprising about this.
These s's aren't just the same, the usual thing, but you somehow switch sigma and tau, and so it's the imaginary part of the s that becomes the usual moduli instead of the real parts. Isn't that what you're doing?
I'm not quite sure I understand the...
Well, okay, I'm trying... It's an open string property and a closed string, but I don't know the exact analogy. But usually, you know, say if it's a closed string propagator, then the real part of S would sort of be the thing, would be the analog of the usual modulus. But if I think of it's... So if I think of what you're doing is sort of like closed string propagators, then then normally it would be the real part of S would be the usual modulus, and the imaginary part would be putting in the projector. But I think it's the same kind of thing, because it's, you know, the usual thing, you take one loop and you do duality and you turn an open string diagram into a closed string diagram.
Right. I mean, so the open string and closed string extremal length are just are just inverses of each other. So I mean, for this whole Riemann surface construction, I've always taken the S to be real, but I mean...
But so. I also want to try and make a similar interpretation, say the imaginary part of S is the usual modulus that sort of goes in the tau direction, and the real part is now the thing that puts in the L0 minus L0 bar projections.
Okay.
Is that...
You have two separate S's. You have two...
No. This is the Schwinger... I mean, this is a Schwinger parameter. This is not... I mean, this is... Yeah. So
that's a Schwinger. S is the Schwinger parameter for L, and S star
is the Schwinger parameter for L star. Exactly.
Right. Yeah, but I want to try and give that a closed string kind of interpretation.
Do you want to make both S and S star? S star is not the complex conjugate.
No, it's not the complex conjugate. So this is these are both real parameters. Sorry, that's maybe...
I don't know if it makes much difference if you do the integrals if you just quick rotate the thing anyway. But I just want to give it that kind of interpretation, which seems sort of natural for a one loop diagram.
I mean, at a Riemann surface, I mean, you know everything about this annulus. I mean, this is just so.
Okay, let me ask you this.
You can think of this annulus in both ways. It doesn't matter.
What happens to S plus S star? What does that do?
changing S plus S
stars. Now what happens, so you have a modulus related only to the S minus S stars. What are the S plus S stars doing?
Oh, good. So, I mean, at the tadpole, they don't do anything. But, I mean, if you have a more general one-loop diagram, of course, this is going to change the open string moduli, i.e. the points where the insertions of open string Fox base tapes end up. So the fact that...
But this isn't something that sort of rotates around the cylinder that's coming from the loop?
I think that broke.
Change the relative positions of the punctures on the outer boundary.
Right, right.
Not the rigid rotation, because that's not a module.
Well, no, because it's a separate one. But
it will affect somehow the relative rotation of the outer and inner boundary as well, if there are punctures in both. Is that right?
Yeah, yes. So in general, we'll do that. But so we also give explicit formulas for where the open string insertions end up, but they are not quite, I mean, they're still very simple compared to the Siegel gauge case, but they're not quite as simple as this one. There are some. They're still explicitly calculable, though.
So all of this is for the tadpole now. Are there all Riemann surfaces?
Okay, so good. So this analysis was okay. So this analysis generalizes to all one-loop amplitudes. So we have not found a very simple representation of two-loop surfaces. But at one-loop level, everything works, and you have. I mean, this formula is not for the tadpole. This formula is in general for anyone. But yeah.
What would you say is missing to have a complete proof that this is a consistent gate choice?
Okay, so there's... Good, so there's two things. One thing is, I mean, the first step should sort of be to show that moduli space is covered. And not just, I mean, this definitely shows that the closed string moduli space is covered in one loop, but you also want the open string moduli space to be covered. And actually, that's not enough. Usually, you'd think that's enough, but at least as far as I understand, that's not going to be enough in this case, because even if you reach all degenerations, you have these extra Qs floating around. So you might cover some part of moduli space, but the Q actually kills this formal way of covering it. So you have to be very careful. But I mean, even as a first step, one should show that...
Would you say the tree level is perfectly fine without further Q?
Well, I mean, as you know from your own paper, that's not quite true. So there is some... What you have to do is you have to, of course... So you have to sort of regularize the range of the Schwinger parameters, and then actually the result of the loop calculations sort of depend on how you take the different cutoffs to infinity. So the question is, how can one, even at loop, even at tree level, generalize the prescription that you were giving on taking these cutoffs to infinity?
Even at tree level, one has to be careful.
Even at tree level, one has to be careful.
For the off-shell, at least.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
For the on shell, nobody really knows, but hopes that perhaps.
And the same prescription works for the one loop?
So we don't know. There are no one loop amplitude has been calculated yet. So
only the moduli problem can be solved, but the full amplitude has not been calculated.
The off-shell full amplitude.
Well, even on-shell, with the loop, you would have to introduce the alternating propagator and make sure everything is healthy, and it's not so easy. Even on-shell tadpole, it's somehow subtle.
I mean, so the subtleties always come from how to find a good regularization of this. So that's the only subtleties that come in. But it needs to be, so, I mean, at the Riemann surface level, everything is soft, but one needs to be a little bit careful. And, yeah, so, okay. I think that at one loop level, at least moduli space is going to be always covered, as you vary all the Schwinger parameters. But as I said, that might not be enough to prove that on-shell amplitudes are correct.
So where do the Qs and Vs come in this analysis? What, do they do funny things you have to watch out? Or?
Well, you don't. Well, so the Q always goes, I mean, right. So it's going to... So in the sliver frame, the Bs always have very simple interpretation. So they are always going to be some kind of a line integral, which is some dz b of z plus some for some coefficient, some z b of z. No, hold on. Let me put the coefficient here. So they are, the integrands of the B contours are going to be at most linear in Z. So they are very simple and very trivial to carry out. So then you have the
alpha. What's alpha?
Oh, alpha is some number. Let me put
where does that come in?
The number. So the number in the end comes from shifting, because we just did a linear shift, and when you do a linear shift on ZBZ, you pick up a number. But I mean, that's just a technical. It's not even a complication.
What do the Qs do? That seems to be a new element. Is that just canceling some B somewhere, or how does it better?
Right. So you need. So what you do is you map it to this frame, and then you move the Qs around. And in sometimes, so as long as you don't, it in some sense kills the B, but you have to be very careful about how the open string insertions move around. Then. So we haven't done this explicitly yet. So it does seem to kill some of the Bs. But I mean, obviously, I mean, just from this representation, you know, it can't be quite that simple. You can't just kill the B. And I mean, something that is formally interesting is that you can always write B over L cube B star over L star as B over L plus Q, something formally Q exact. Now, this works for regular linear B gauges. This is actually this can be made precise, and so you can even see that you don't even need to use the full propagator for regular linear B gauges if you are just interested in the on-shell part of the amplitudes, because you're just going to get correction by Q exact pieces. But this identity is very subtle in Schnabel gauge because of this regularization issue, so one has to watch out and keep the correction terms that appear on the side. Any other questions? Maybe we should give Yuji a chance, and we can ask me later if you have any further questions.
In topological strings, Q and B0 somehow has this, one is kind of like related to the other. But one is G plus, one is G minus. So this is the emission conjugate of the other. You can't do something similar to Schnabel gauge for the gear.
The truth is, I don't know. We'd have to think.